calling State Affairs to Order on Tuesday, March 1, 2022 in the Max Grunberg Room. Welcome everybody and members present. We have from my left to right, Representatives Vance, Tarr, Kaufman, myself, Chair Christ Tompkins, Representative Story, and Klayman. And with six members present and a quorum to conduct business, we will get going. And many thanks to Sophia, who, as always from House Records, helps ensure that we have a record of today's meeting, as well as Alex B.B. Gucce in the back with LAA for moderating and quarterbacking the comms on today's meeting. Thanks to Jeff, as always, our committee aide, for making the committee possible. Housekeeping and deadline notes. As previously noted, there's an amendment deadline for HJR 29 from Representative Rauscher relating to supporting the USPS related legislation in Congress. That amendment deadline is 5 p.m. tomorrow. And as previously noted in this committee, I'm also going to note an amendment submission deadline to legislative legal to eliminate any and all possible excuses for amendments to come in late after deadline. And that time is being set for 9 p.m. tonight. So if you don't submit your amendment to legislative legal by 9 p.m. tonight, under no circumstances will it be accepted or entertained. So just be sure to get on those amendments in a timely fashion. And given that the personal bill deadline is passed from legal, I imagine turnaround times are at least a little bit improved, hopefully for their sake and ours and everybody's. So with the deadline and timekeeping pieces noted, we have three items on today's agenda: HJR 29, SB 71, and then finally HB 234. We'll start with HJR 29 from Representative Rauscher and Mr. Ryan McKee, Staff Rep Rauscher. Welcome to the committee, Representative Rauscher. Mr. McKee, please come forward and put yourselves on record and go ahead and present the legislation.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Chairman Christ Tompkins for and the members of the committee for hearing this timely bill. HJR 29, Representative George Rauscher, District 9. Thank you for the record. HJR 29 recognizes that the United States Postal Service plays a crucial role in communities across Alaska, especially in areas of Alaska accessible only by air or water. We have seen over the years that prices have been rising, while at the same time delivery of mail has been slowed. The Postal Service has also lost $69 billion over the past 11 fiscal years, in addition to unfunded liabilities that are twice the amount of their annual revenue. This is noticeable in rural Alaska, where the federal government's failure to recognize the need for adequate staffing has hit those communities especially hard. Mr. Chairman, many rural areas in the state of Alaska, in my area, and I know probably a lot of the other areas in the state that other representatives represent, Delta, Valdez, Sutton, areas like that, their post offices have had, it's really hard to keep them staffed adequately. Their lines are long. They go out the door on a Saturday. The lines go out the door later on in the day when people are picking up packages. So this resolution would send a formal request from the Alaska State Legislature to Congress asking them to pass H.R. 3076, the Post Office, the Postal Service Reform Act of 2022, and finally would request the United States Congress pass Senate Bill 4614, the Postal Banking Act of 2020. Time is of the essence, and action is required to preserve the United States Postal Service and the services that it provides for the residents of the state of Alaska. I will now turn over the testimony to my Chief of Staff, Ryan McKee, for any other comments that you may have or questions. Thank you.
For the record, Ryan McKee, Staff to Representative George Rauscher. So we are making one amendment, and we'll work through the chair on this one. This simply changes Senate Bill 1720, and we're going to update it with HR 3076. We all know some bills move faster than others, and in this case, the HR 3076 was actually passed through the House, and so now it's over in the Senate, and so we want to make sure that if this resolution does go through, we're urging the proper bill. And so that change, well, again, we'll work with you, with the chair, on getting this one submitted.
That sounds great. Thank you very much, Mr. McKee and Representative Rauscher. For the committee's reference, we do have testimony, invited testimony on this legislation, Alan Swarm, the mayor pro tem for the city of Valdez. But maybe just in this moment, any sort of immediate pants on fire questions from the committee, Representative Klingon?
Sounds like two Senate bills, and now you've got a House bill. Can you let us know who are the sponsors of those three different bills?
Let's see here.
Or you can look it up during the invite.
Let me get back to you on that real quick.
Representative Story.
Thank you, Representative Story, through the chair. I'm just wondering if you could tell me some highlights about the bills. I'm not sure. I have not read them, and I would appreciate knowing some of the highlights.
Yes. So for HR 3076, this is the Postal Service Reform Act of 2022. The bill would require the Office of Personnel Management to create the Postal Service Health Benefits Program for postal employees and retirees, and it repeals the requirement that the USPS pre-fund future retiree health benefits. The USPS would be required to deliver mail 6 days a week and to create an online dashboard with service performance data at the national and local level. And the bill would allow USPS to form strategic partnerships with state, local, and tribal governments to provide non-postal and non-commercial services. And then for the Banking Act, that one is going to be, it would be a pilot program. It'd be aimed at providing low interest loans to the low income communities. It would also work to establish through the post office ATMs, checking accounts, savings. It's basically an alternative. This was done in response to the COVID-19 pandemic to create an opportunity for low income households to have alternative options from rather than going through predatory loans or high interest loans. And also kind of really shows, especially in rural Alaska, that there aren't brick and mortar banks all over the place. And so this would kind of help address that issue. And again, aimed at rural and low income communities.
Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, at this time we'll go to invited testimony. Mr. Sorum, Mayor Pro Tem Sorum, if you can hear us, please go ahead, put yourself on record, and proceed with your invited testimony.
Thank you. My name is Alan Sorum, representing the City of Valdez as Mayor Pro Tem. Thank you for Representative George Rauscher introducing this resolution, and I encourage the committee to recommend passage of this resolution. While the Postal Service has its detractors, the system works well for Alaskans when it's properly supported. The United States Postal Service is vital to our state and especially its rural residents. Valdez, like other communities in Alaska, has seen disruptions in our local postal service marked by personnel shortages and staffing issues. Nationally, the service has seen problems with its governance, funding, service provided, and the cost of service. Our federal delegation has been working to resolve some of these issues, recognizing the importance of the Postal Service to the state. Unfortunately, in the lower states, there is less regard for the service and no understanding of the agency's important role outside the contiguous states. This resolution is meant to support our federal delegation in its efforts to pass legislation addressing reform of the Postal Service. Our delegation appreciates actions like this that bolster their efforts and demonstrate to their colleagues public support of the proposed legislation. A few years ago, Representative Rauscher and I worked on a similar resolution supporting the Secure Rural Schools program. So the Postal Service Reform Act of 2021, there was a question about it. It's co-sponsored by Senators Murkowski and Sullivan. And as it was just mentioned, the companion bill, H.R. 3076, passed the House and is co-sponsored by Representative Young. The bill repeals the requirement that the UPS annually prepay future retirement health benefits. There's no other agency in government that's had to do that. It allows agreements with local and tribal governments to provide certain non-postal products and property to the public. And an example would be the passport program that the Postal Service does for the State Department. It requires a publicly available dashboard to track their performance. And the big one is it requires mail delivery to occur at least 6 days a week. The Postal Banking Act of 2020 didn't pass in the previous Congress, but it could be added to other legislation. According to the Federal Reserve, about 63 million Americans are unbanked, lacking access to a commercial banking facility. And another interesting statistic was 90% of the zip codes that are unbanked are in rural America. Many rural Alaskans would fit into this category. The objective is to close this gap since the post office operates 34,000 locations across the country. And up until 1966, the Postal Service did offer these types of banking services. The bill and other recent proposals would help serve under and unbanked, and a secondary objective was it would help the Postal Service with its deficit. The Office of Inspector General reported that modest fees for these financial services would bring in nearly $9 billion a year if only 10% of those currently underbanked use this service. And so thank you for your time, and please consider passage of this resolution that would benefit the entire state.
A question?
Thank you, Mayor Sorum. And there's a question from the committee, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. Now, you'd mentioned that the post office had previously explored and had a part in banking. Do you know why they stepped away and don't currently offer those services?
Well, what law I read on it, it started after the Depression, I think, in 1910, because banks were having a hard time, and there had to be a place where people could access their savings and get basic banking services. And from what I read, it just sort of ran out of steam in the early 60s, and the growth of branch banking and other services out there. The idea didn't come up again until a couple of years ago.
Thank you.
Representative Klayman.
The provisions in the federal bills relating to unfunded liabilities for pension payments, or the requirement to prepay the pensions?
I don't know the timeline on it, but several years ago.
Let me finish my question. With regard to that pre-funding question, did the legislation still keep in place the pension obligations? It's just no longer requiring pre-funding it?
Yes. It establishes an organization to look over that, and then they plan on shifting it all into Medicare, where apparently it wouldn't be much of a fraction of what's already there. And as far as I know or read, postal employees and other people involved with it don't have any issues with that.
Thank you.
Any further questions from the committee for Mayor Sorum? Seeing none, thank you very much, Mayor, for making the time to present testimony. Circling back, any questions, additional questions from the committee for the sponsor, Representative Eastman?
Thank you. Now, I'm looking on page 2. It says in the resolution that the United States Postal Service has lost $69 billion in the last 11 years. Is that number accurate?
Through the chair, Ryan, for the record, Ryan McKee. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, yes.
Follow-up? So they've lost $69 billion, and it says here that they have unsustainable unfunded liabilities that are twice annual revenues. And the fix is for the Postal Service, which is going bankrupt, to get into banking. Am I following that correctly?
For the record, Ryan McKee, through the chair, Representative Eastman, yes, through the pilot program, I believe they estimated they could raise about $9 billion annually through the low-interest loans and the banking through checking and savings accounts.
Follow up. And where are they going to get the money with which to issue these interest low-interest loans?
I can get back to you on that. I don't have that here.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions from the committee, thank you very much, Representative Rauscher, Mr. McKee. We have this legislation noticed on Thursday, and what I'd like to do in this moment is go ahead and announce an intent. Is that a late in the coming question, Representative Kaufman?
I just wanted to comment on this.
Sure, go ahead.
Through the chair to the bill sponsor, I think really the majority of the questions are what's in the underlying legislation that this is referring to, and is that good legislation? And that's, I don't have questions because that's really the big question that I have, and those answers aren't here. Kind of relating to the prior question of about the 60, I was counting zeros trying to make sure I was going to say that right. But anyway, I think that's the question is what's happening at the federal level, is it actually good? And it may have parts of it that help us, but is it good on the whole? Yeah, it's just the only question that I have, so I'll have to look at that. If we get a chance to get more information from you on kind of the sectional analysis, the sponsor statements on what those are about, the summaries of what that legislation is about, it could help put some of these questions to the side. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kaufman, and point well taken. Maybe homework for Rep. Rauscher and Mr. McKee in terms of questions on the underlying federal legislation for Thursday. My intent would be that we go ahead and notice public testimony and set an amendment deadline for this on Thursday. However, if there are reservations or a slower pace would be preferred, happy to go that direction. But all equal, what I was going to suggest is an amendment submission deadline at 5 p.m. tomorrow and a submission deadline of 9 p.m. tonight. But Representative Eastman?
Since I don't currently see it in the bill packet, is there by chance a way we can get like a sectional of the legislation that we're recommending here, like those two pieces of legislation? I think that would help probably every member of the committee.
Yeah, Mr. McKee?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, for the H.R. 3076, since that is a piece of legislation right now, yes, I'll work on getting that.
And wasn't there a second bill in there somewhere, too?
The Banking Act was introduced in the last Congress, but it died. Parts of it can be put into existing legislation, but it has not. Nobody's done that yet.
So which parts of it are we recommending here, I guess? And can we get a sectional on those parts?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Eastman, yes, we can get sectional analysis done for the – what we're asking is we're urging Congress to – pass the legislation currently being discussed, which is H.R. 3076, and then in addition, we're urging them to bring the Banking Act back up again and also pass that.
Thank you.
Maybe what I'll suggest we'll do public testimony on Thursday and then take it up for final consideration next week to give a little bit more runway and sort of consideration for the committee and opportunity for engagement between the sponsor and the committee. So, yes, Representative Klayman.
Just for clarity, it might help. It sounds like they have an amended version. Maybe that could appear by Thursday as a committee substitute. So we're actually looking at the proposed legislation as a committee substitute rather than an amendment, because since they actually are talking about a different bill, that seems like more akin to a committee substitute than an amendment.
Yeah, my understanding is it's just substituting out the reference to which legislation is at play. I would just suggest maybe the sponsor can circulate that to the committee so all of us have definitive clarity on what federal pieces of legislation we're talking about, but we can take up amendment deadlines on Thursday, but potentially take this up again next Tuesday, a week from now, providing a little bit more runway, and nail the specifics from there if that seems reasonable. So thank you very much, Representative Rauscher, Mr. McKee, for the legislation presentation, and we'll see you back on Thursday for public testimony, and then again subsequent Tuesday. That takes us to the next item on today's calendar. This is SB 71 from Senator Stevens, relating to Alaska State Council on the Arts and license plates and management of art. This is technically the second hearing, although the first this calendar year. When we heard from the sponsor on May 15, 2021, we had a sectional analysis, sponsor introduction, and invited testimony, but I think anyone would be forgiven if recall is not 100% on that all, so maybe we can sort of do a light refresh on the legislation. And to that end, Senator Stevens and Mr. Lampkin, welcome, and welcome back, I should say. It's great to have such a strong State Affairs Office of Senator Stevens connection here with all your great legislation coming over to our side. And go ahead and maybe just refresh us on the legislation, and we can see if there are any questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the comments about refreshing our memory. It seems like a long time ago, but basically, Senate Bill 71 is a bill that came about at the request of the Alaska State Council on the Arts. They asked us to run this. And so the result of it's a result of complications in their budget structure that occurred in the 2019 budget cycle, provides some stability to that organization, gives them an opportunity to be less reliant on general fund. It's not just about license plates. It does not create a new plate. It only amends the existing program, providing the Arts Council some additional revenue from their supporters. It also provides a means for possible legal representation from time to time should that be needed. The bill intends to hold harmless the private funding raising efforts of the Arts Council, setting up a new fund, the Arts and Cultural Investment Fund. That fund is for those privately raised monies to be funneled and managed by the Arts Council. It makes the competitive four-year artistic license plate project optional instead of mandatory, and it allows the option for the Arts Council to compensate the winning license plate artist, a very modest award. Basically, very simple. Mr. Chairman, that's what it does.
Thank you. Questions from the committee given that excellent refresh? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and I'm sorry, I'm not remembering a lot of discussion on this from last year. There's a new section in Section 5 about the legal counsel, and I'm wondering, why are we adding that section to statute?
And again, that was the request of the Arts Council. Tim, could you go over that for them?
Thank you. For the record, Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens, through the chair, Representative Eastman. That is in response to some processes that occurred during the budget cycle, that their budget was being vetoed, and other matters that required representation that put the Department of Law in conflict with the interests of the Arts Council. That's it in a summary. We have Mr. Ben Brown online, who really needs to be doing most of the talking at this hearing.
Yeah, absolutely. And just for members' reference, Ben Brown, chair of the State Council on Arts, is online, as well as Andrew Noble, the executive director of State Council on Arts, as well as Jeff Schmitz, director of DMV. Mr. Brown, if you caught the question, would you be able to field an answer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members of the House State Affairs Committee, for hearing Senate Bill 71. First, I just want to thank Senator Stevens for introducing this legislation, Mr. Lampkin for all his good work on it, and I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and your staff, Mr. Stepp, for scheduling us for that briefest of hearings last May, which was a long time ago, and for the time today and later this week to actually delve into this legislation more substantively in hopes that it can continue to make progress to become law. So, Mr. Chairman, to respond to Representative Eastman's question about legal counsel, when the vetoes happened in 2019, it was a challenging time for me as chairman for the staff, and I needed to consult with the Department of Law about some of the legal questions that arose when we were being shut down as an agency. I was able to speak to the Assistant Attorney General, who represents the Department of Education and Early Development, where we are housed administratively under our enabling statute in Title 44, Chapter 27. And
Mr. Brown, we...
Sorry
to interrupt. The line went dead there for just a couple of seconds. Maybe could you rewind two or three sentences and go from there? Hopefully that wasn't on our end, but the audio did go out.
Okay, very good. And maybe it was me speaking too rapidly, which I've been known to do in committee hearings over the course of the last couple of decades. But when the vetoes happened in 2019, we as an agency needed legal advice. And so I contacted the Assistant Attorney General at the Department of Law, who represents the Department of Education and Early Development on general matters. She was also working with the Commissioner and the Deputy Commissioner of Education to implement what the administration had done, shutting down the agency. Well, obviously, I didn't want that to happen. And under the Alaska Rules of Professional Conduct, an attorney cannot represent two clients who have adverse interests. And at that point, there was kind of an irreconcilable adversity of interest between what we were trying to do as the State Council on the Arts and what the Department of Education and Early Development was trying to do. And I didn't want to see a hardworking, talented Assistant Attorney General put in that position. From my prior experience of almost 8 years on the Commercial Fisheries Industry Commission, I was aware that there was a specific section in the Limited Entry Act that provided that the Attorney General, the Department of Law, was legal counsel for CFEC. And it just seemed wise and prudent to me to make a similar provision in the enabling statute for the State Council on the Arts. What that practically means is a different attorney would be assigned than the one who's representing the Department of Education and Early Development. So, Mr. Chairman, to respond to sort of the substance of Representative Easton's question, we hope we don't need to go and spend time and money through a reimbursable services agreement to consult with the Department of Law. But if we have to, we want to do it in a manner that's not putting an employee there in an ethically questionable situation. And I can provide more examples if I need to. And I think what may not have been heard is I am, of course, a member of the Alaska Bar, have been since 2002. So it was immediately obvious to me that that was not a good place for our assistant AG to have to be.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Any follow-up, Representative Eastman?
Thank you. And just trying to nail down that conflict of interest bit. So, and maybe CFEC is a good example to compare to, I'm not sure, but if the Attorney General is working to implement a policy agenda from the administration dealing with, let's say, you know, reducing staff or maybe even eliminating an agency like the council, are we in putting this language into statute, assigning the Attorney General as legal counsel for the council, are we then telling the Attorney General basically by law that they're not going to be able to help the administration implement that policy agenda?
Mr. Brown, can you hear us if you wouldn't mind? Oh, looks like the line may be dead. Well, let's just put a pin in that, and hopefully Mr. Brown will be back soon enough with us. Representative Tarr, did you have a question?
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to add, because the physical location was in my district, a little bit around that whole issue that he pretty clearly described, but it was just a major issue of physically what to do because of, you know, if an agency just evaporates, which is basically the circumstance without any, like, wind down, which I think if we were going to do that, we would, that's would be the route to go. So I just wanted to add that was a real scramble in our area, and folks were wondering what the heck to do. And if you're a legislator, you may have Alaska State Council on the Arts art in your office. There's art distributed through public buildings, so that was another issue of ownership, legality, transfer. So anyhow, thank you.
Yeah. Lots of any questions. Representative Story.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, and welcome, Senator Stevens and Mr. Lampkin. Good to have you before us again. My question has to do with, on page 3, the section that puts together the Arts Alaska Arts and Cultural Investment Fund. And I see that appropriations to the fund do not lapse. It's one of the on line 24 and 25. But I was wondering about, is this fund sweepable since it's in the general fund? And is there anyway, any thoughts about the fund being sweepable and that there's something different we should be doing with this fund?
Through Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens, through the chair, Representative Story. So AS 3705142 are in regard to program receipts. And that was set up specifically, the Arts Council is a public corporation, so it's dealing with public monies and private monies at the same time. In this instance, it was to hold harmless those monies that they go out and gather up privately from donations, donors, and that those monies be held harmless in the event that their budget is vetoed. In this instance, when their budget was wiped clean, then they had several hundreds of thousands of dollars that they were put in a position to have to go back to and find those individual donors and return that money. And so this would hold those funds harmless for purposes of the budget process. And I understand Mr. Brown's back online.
He is indeed back online. Representative Story, would be helpful to Mr. Brown, if you caught that question from Representative Story, feel free to add on to Mr. Lampkin's answer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize. I just got AirPods, and if you touch them at all, apparently it drops the call. So, but at any rate, to respond to Representative Story's question, Mr. Chairman, I believe that these funds actually would be sweepable. What this will do if we create this new subsection 80 with an Alaska Arts and Cultural Investment Fund is just delineate for anyone who's looking at the budget and making decisions about vetoes and fiscal policy that these are private foundation funds that are being invested by our partners like the Rasmussen Foundation in the work we do at the Public Corporation of the State. What we are not doing, which had been done in the original version of the bill, is exempting ASCA's budgets, including the statutorily designated program receipts, from the Budget Act. So it's in no way a diminution of the legislature's constitutional authority to appropriate money, or indeed the governor's constitutional prerogative to veto. It simply illustrates that these funds are special and different than undesignated general funds and designated general funds. But I'm not an expert on sweepability. And so I would defer to probably someone from Ledge Finance about that. But my understanding is it will not practically really make a difference in that sort of fiscal policy question. But what it will do is make it, you know, crystal clear that we are going out and getting well over half of our budget from non-governmental sources to invest in creating arts and culture activity for Alaska.
Representative Story?
Yes, follow up. I would like to have the answer to that question is if the fund is sweepable or not. So at some point, thank you.
Yeah, and I might just add, brief at ease. Did in that question, just to go ahead and state my orientation, I would prefer to see the funds non-sweepable and we may be able to have legislative finance join us shortly, but Representative Clinton may also have his insight.
Specifically on that topic, I would actually, because the topic of sweepability has become, in the last 3 years, has become far more unresolved than it was prior to the current administration. And I know that from other presentations we've had that there's different ways the question of sweepability or non-sweepability has been addressed in statute. And I would actually not just have a kind of a comment from finance, but I'd actually like to see in writing the Attorney General's position as to whether what this language says about sweepability, and to the extent we're interested in making these funds non-sweepable, what the Attorney General thinks satisfies the test for being non-sweepable, because I think this is a complicated. It didn't used to be so complicated, but I don't think there's clarity about what language one wants to not. If the intent of the legislature is for the fund not to be sweepable, how do we do that and get agreement amongst the Attorney General and legislative legal? I don't think we should get it from one or the other. We should get it from both and in writing.
Yeah, that's well advised. And maybe we can work with the sponsor to solicit that. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. To follow up on the question about holding harmless, which specific provision of the bill are we talking about there?
I'd need a moment to review the bill.
And Representative Eastman, what page or line are you referring to?
That's while we were talking about it. I'm trying to figure out what page.
I think it's section 6 of the bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, so 4427059 is outside of the Executive Budget Act, and so therefore it would not necessarily, if I understand correctly, be the sweepable question aside, not be subject to outright veto for those receipts, just the receipts, not the agency's budget in and of itself, but just the receipt authority. I defer again to Ben Brown, who's intimately more acquainted with their budget than the agency.
Mr. Brown?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, to return to what Representative Klayman said, Mr. Chairman, if this legislation becomes law, which I hope it does, Section 3 of the bill adds paragraph 80 to 375146C. That will be the 80th fund there. So this is not uncharted territory. It's just a new fund there. So I think the question about sweepability is going to relate to all the other funds in 375146C. And so, Mr. Chairman, I think Representative Klayman is not at all ill-advised in wanting an answer. And I would respectfully say that finance could provide that. But certainly if the Attorney General is able to provide some guidance on this administration's position on that as well. But I don't think there would be anything on the face of the bill in the new language that would differentiate the Alaska Arts and Cultural Investment Fund from the other 79 funds in 375146C. I think obviously it's going to be, unless there's other legal precedents or provisions from other sections of statute or perhaps even constitutional law, I don't know why this would be any different than any of those other funds.
Well, yes, Representative Eastman.
So specifically dealing with the funds received from non-government sources, foundations and the like, is there something we're doing in this bill which is going to take away from either the legislature or the governor's ability to veto or limit the receipt authority? Because I think that the question of, you know, how to, through the bill, protect the donor money so that the council doesn't have to return it to donors. I think that was part of the intent here. I'm trying to figure out the mechanism by which that's going to take place and if we are curtailing the governor or the legislature's authority in doing so.
Mr. Chairman, I'll try to answer that if I may.
Yes, please proceed.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastman is asking if we're diminishing legislative appropriation authority or gubernatorial veto authority. We are not. The reason the bill reads as it currently does, and it passed the Senate unanimously in the form that's now before the committee, is because Senator Wilson raised that question before the bill passed in Senate Finance last year. So that's a question I'm very confident in answering in the negative. No, we are not diminishing appropriative authority or veto authority. The legislature will still have to give the State Council on the Arts the ability to receive statutorily designated program receipts, but they will go into a fund that's different than the way it's currently structured. And if, in the I hope event that never happens again, where we were vetoed out of existence, the process for accounting for and returning those funds would probably have more clarity. I guess, if I may, Mr. Chairman, provide some of the background. There was a great deal of concern among our foundation partners, both in Alaska and outside, about what was going to happen to the very significant sums of money that they had already invested in through the Alaska State Council on the Arts and activities in Alaska. And I think the main intent of this is not to prevent the legislature from deciding whether or not we should be able to receive those funds or prevent the governor from deciding whether or not he or she should veto those funds, but to make sure that those funds are in a specific place so that those entities that are investing them have a degree of confidence in the transparency of where they are. But again, hopefully this is all a hypothetical conversation and we're never going to be vetoed out of existence again. Nevertheless, we thought it prudent to, while having this legislation move through the process, try to take some steps to provide them with a greater degree of confidence than existed in 2019.
Representative Clayman.
Now, I guess I will respectfully take a somewhat different perspective than Mr. Brown is articulating. I think the question for this committee and for the Senate, to the extent we don't fully agree with them, I think the question we want to ask ourselves is, for money that was either donated to the State Council for the Arts by non-state government entities, or money in prior years appropriated by this legislature to the State Council of the Arts, do we want that to be sweepable? And I have no confidence that 3705146C answers that question in the current environment. I think that's a decision we need to make. And if there's uncertainty, then we should, and if we don't want it to be sweepable, we need to write this legislation in a way that says this is not sweepable. Or if our view is it can be sweepable, then we can say it's sweepable. But I don't think just saying, oh, it's in this statute answers that question. And I respect his, I'm not asking a question, Mr. Brown, I'm just making a comment to the chair. But I think that's the question we need to have clarity on before we take action on this legislation. And I don't think that answer comes from the financial division. I think we need to have prospective counsel weigh in, because they're the folks that will litigate it if we get yet another lawsuit about what's sweepable and what's not.
Noted.
Mr. Chairman, if I may?
Yes, Mr. Brown, you may.
Mr. Chairman, I in no way question the sincerity or the value of the line of inquiry that Representative Clayman is pursuing. It's just something that wasn't an issue a year ago to the extent that it is now. And so it's not something, I guess it's an issue of first impression to me, looking at this legislation in a way that it wasn't before. So by all means, you know, let's answer the questions now and not leave them unresolved. I think that's very prudent.
Thank you. And to the subject, Kelly O'Sullivan from Legislative Finance is now online, and Representative Clayman noted that we would want, ideally, council's perspective from both branches of government. And I think it would behoove us to work towards that. Ms. O'Sullivan, as you may have already been briefed, we're discussing possible sweepability of the fund being established under SB 71, and specifically the question whether such a fund is or is not sweepable. And just given that this is not the Finance Committee, are there any sort of overall comments that you might offer to sort of inform our perspective on this question as we may dive deeper in the future?
For the record, Kelly O'Sullivan, Legislative Finance. Because this is written that money appropriated to the fund can be spent without further appropriation, it would not be sweepable. Because it is not available for appropriation after it's in the fund.
Ms. O'Sullivan, given what you know about this administration's interpretation of sweepability, would you be able to comment about, I realize this is a tricky question, but how you might assess the administration's perspective on sweepability? We're not going to take this as you know, the word of God by any means, but just given that there are public positions out there and litigation that has occurred by the administration on questions of sweepability, could you speak to that?
I would suspect that they would determine it not sweepable, but obviously I can't answer that.
Okay. Any questions for Legislative Finance from the committee? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So then if I'm following along, I'd be looking on page three, lines 28 and 29, where it says, and to pay the cost of administering the fund without further appropriation. Those are our key important words.
Ms. O'Sullivan?
I'm just reading the words before it. The council may spend money appropriated to the fund to carry out the purposes of this chapter and to pay the cost of administering the fund without further appropriation. So it might be that to carry out the purpose of this chapter is more significant. Of course, I'm not an attorney.
Let's take a few more questions on this. I want to definitely put a pin on this by 4 o'clock. Representative Vance. Oh, Representative Tarr, follow up and then Representative Vance.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just so I understand this, because it sounded like at first you were saying, you know, this fund would not be sweepable because the bill is written in a way to say, you know, that the funds can be spent without further appropriation. Is there another place in the bill that I am looking for where those words are? Because if that's what we're looking for, I just, for comfort, would like to see those words. And the only ones I thought I saw were the ones I just shared.
Kelly O'Sullivan, you know, those might be some legal technicalities that I can't answer. But in general, if a fund is established and it can be spent without further appropriation, it is not subject to the sweep.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'll confirm with Ledge Legal that we've got the words just perfectly that accomplishes that. So we're all know what's happening.
And if you wouldn't mind, Representative Tarr, let the committee and the sponsor know what Legislative Legal says, and we'd be grateful. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have questions of clarification along the same lines and understanding the entire Section 6. So the fund consists of money appropriated to the fund by the legislature. So the mechanism is we are funding the Arts Council program, and that goes into one pot. Then what this particular area is the program receipts and the donations. Once the legislature puts money into that pot, they have the ability to utilize that without it sweeping. But if the question is, to please explain, if the legislature does not make an annual appropriation to the fund, what happens with the other funds, with like the donations that are received?
And who do you want to direct that question to?
Finance.
Okay. Ms. O'Sullivan, please proceed.
Kelly O'Sullivan, Legislative Finance. Typically, that money stays in the fund.
Follow up.
And I think the question here on line 24 and 25 says appropriations to the fund do not lapse, but what does lapse are the donations. Is that correct?
Legislative Finance, Kelly O'Sullivan. Typically, donations do not lapse.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to chew on this.
Representative Clayman.
So this is for Ms. O'Sullivan as well. When I'm reading lines 20, this is on page 3, lines 22, 23, and 24. The fund consists of money appropriated to the fund by the legislature, including donations, money from other sources, and interest earned on money in the fund. Do you read that sentence as meaning if I contribute $100 to the Alaska State Council on the Arts, that $100 would actually be a contribution to the general fund, and then the legislature has to appropriate that $100 to the council, to this fund? Am I reading that right, or am I reading that wrong?
Kelly O'Sullivan, generally, all money appropriated to the fund, including donations, general fund program receipts, you put that in the appropriation.
But that's not really the question I'm asking is, even if my check says Alaska State Council for the Arts, isn't that check, under the way this language is written, truly a contribution to the general fund? And unless the legislature then appropriates that onto the State Council for the Arts, the State Council of the Arts doesn't have that $100 until the legislature takes action?
I believe that is true. Now, that might be another thing to clarify with legal, but usually it does take an appropriation to put money into a fund.
Thank you.
it may behoove us to have legal here at a future hearing, but that question may be worth getting definitive clarity on. Final line of questioning before setting the bill aside for now. I believe the line dropped when Representative Eastman was asking about Section 5 on the legal counsel question. Representative Eastman, did you want to re-ask that question?
Thank you, and I don't know that you were able to hear the question, so I'll restate it. But in Section 5, the bill currently gives the Attorney General an assignment as legal counsel for the council. And I'm just wondering, does that create an impediment to the Attorney General, the Department of Law, carrying out an administration's policy decision to do something with the council, add, subtract, you know, eliminate, what have you, you know, something that the council might not approve of?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastman, I can actually tell you from personal experience as a commercial fisheries entry commissioner, that's the whole reason it's sort of necessary. When the Walker administration attempted to rewrite the Limited Entry Act through administrative order in a manner that I considered unconstitutional, and ultimately that administrative order was withdrawn, we were assigned a different assistant attorney general at the Department of Law, because the assistant attorney general at the Department of Law that was attempting to do what we didn't think was constitutional could not possibly have advised both CFEC and the Department of Fish and Game and the Walker administration. So ultimately, it would not prevent the governor from implementing his or her policy objectives. It would just provide adequate legal representation to both entities as those policy decisions unfolded. And that's the point of this. And again, it didn't rise to the same level of conflict, I think, in 2019 with the vetoes, but it did put the assistant attorney general, who was attempting to advise us and the Department of Education and Early Development, in an ethically untenable position. But ultimately, no. I mean, governors in Alaska, as you know, are among the most powerful governors in our country, and they're going to be able to do what they want to do, but we don't want that to have that happen in a manner that is unstructured and exposes the agency to liability. And when we talk about the liability, that could be vis-a-vis its employees whose jobs were vetoed out of existence, and it could certainly be vis-a-vis the foundation partners who are investing non-governmental money in our work. So having the advice of counsel is, as I'm sure, Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastman, you appreciate, just a prudent step. But at the end of the day, it's not going to create any sort of insurmountable obstacle. It's just going to make sure that things happen in an orderly way that doesn't create more liability for the state.
Is there time for one final follow-up?
Yeah.
So on that, would the council be opposed to distinguishing here in this section between counsel as far as in an advisory capacity, being able to consult with, you know, an assistant attorney general versus counsel in a representative capacity? Because I'm just trying to avoid the scenario where we have the state suing itself if the council is trying to go one way and the governor is trying to go another way.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastman, I don't think that's possible under the rules of professional conduct in Alaska. As an Alaska bar member, I don't think you can put one toe in the swimming pool. If you're representing someone as an attorney, you need to represent that person as an attorney. Now, the ultimate decision that's going to be made is going to be by the supervisor of that assistant attorney general. So it's going to rise up above the level of the person who's writing the motions and taking the phone calls from me or from Ms. Noble. And at some point, the attorney general might say, we're not going to do that. We're pulling the plug on that. And at that point, I don't think that is a necessary step. I don't think it comports with the way law is practiced in Alaska or in our country. I understand what you're asking, but Mr. Chairman, I would say that preventing that sort of a situation would happen in a different manner than what you're suggesting amending the bill might be necessary to do.
Thank you for help clarifying that.
Thank you. And I want to close down this line of questioning, Representative Clayman, on the subject.
You know, I've got actually more than a couple of questions on this topic. So I'd rather than start down that path, I think we probably should have Mr. Brown back. I also, I actually would request that we have the Attorney General here at the next round, because I actually find the whole topic about the conflict of interest issue, one that I think we need to hear from the Attorney General and their perspective on that, because all I can say is so far I'm just curious.
And Mr. Lampkin, forgive me, I know you maybe had a comment to this line of questioning. Please proceed if there's anything you'd like to add.
Tim Lampkin, Staff Assistant Stevens, just as I want to bring to your attention that this question, this area was covered quite a bit in the other body, and the amendment was made that specifically page 3, lines 17-18, we added, legal counsel for good cause and with the approval of the Attorney General, and that was negotiated with the Department of Law. Everyone, at least to date, has been holding hands on that subject. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may, ever so briefly?
Yes, Mr. Brown.
Thank you, sir. And we have endeavored at the State Council on the Arts to work with Governor Dunleavy and his administration on this legislation, and are firmly of the belief that it is something that he's ready to sign when passed by this body, whether that needs to go back to the other body for concurrence or not. So I think Mr. Lampkin did a fine job explaining that we did look at this very thoroughly. But Mr. Chairman, if everyone's an appointment, I don't know that I can answer these questions, but I would like to put myself at the committee's disposal to try to make sure these questions are answered so that doesn't become an impediment to the bill's passage.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. With all respect to the work done in the other body, I think we will probably want to hear from the Department of Law ourselves. And so if that could be arranged, Mr. Brown or the sponsor's office or whomever, I think there's probably sufficient committee interest to that. And Representative Kaufman, do you have a question or comment on this line?
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor. As I look at this, I see the change in the funding stream. So my understanding, there's federal matching, and then there's the state originated funding. And so with this license plate surcharge, so that's creating a codifying a new funding stream. Does that what in the end, what does the funding stream look like? So if we have, X for federal and then X anticipated from the surcharge, is the rest made up by grants, donations, that sort of thing? Is this that much of a success if we can get there? More information.
I'm just going to interject. I think that's a new line of questioning from Section 5 where we're at, and just given time, maybe we put a pin on it, but start with that on Thursday.
Okay.
I know there's a number of other questions on from the committee on other sections as well, so TBD, if that sounds good, just to ensure that we've got time for the last item on today's agenda. And I definitely want to make sure that we have sufficient committee time to get all these questions answered and give the bill consideration and momentum. So thank you very much, Senator Stevens and Mr. Lampkin, for being here, and Mr. Brown, Ms. Noble, Mr. Schmitz, and Ms. O'Sullivan for being online and available. And with that, we'll set the bill aside until Thursday and await word from Legislegal via Representative Tarr and perhaps the pleasure of Department of Law's presence on Thursday as well, if that's possible. So thank you to all associated with SB 71. That takes us to the final item on today's agenda, HB 234 from Representative Schrage. Welcome, Representative Schrage and Mr. Gunderson. And where we left things off here before we hit time in the previous hearing was we had three amendments introduced, amendments 1, 2, and 3, I.8, I.7, I.9, and we had amendment number 1 from Representative Klayman, I.8, on the table. And as I think has been communicated or distributed by email, I've also circulated a new amendment, I.10, and just sort of in the interest of avoiding sort of amendment to the amendment confusion, just intend to exercise the chair's prerogative to introduce that as a fresh amendment rather than amend previous amendments. So we can save that to the very end, but right now we have an amendment on the table from Representative Klayman, amendment number 1, Representative Klayman.
And so, Mr. Chair, amendment, I'm going to withdraw is I.8 is the number one. I'm going to withdraw amendment I.8.
Number one, I.8 has been withdrawn. Takes us to the next amendment in the queue, amendment number two, I.7, Representative Klayman.
And Mr. Chair, I am not going to offer amendment number two, which is I.7.
Okay, that takes us to the third amendment in the queue, amendment number three, I.9 from Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I'll move I.9, but can I offer a caveat when I do?
You certainly can, and I'm just going to quickly object for purposes of process.
Thank you, and I value the discussion and conversation that we did on a previous bill, which had this same amendment, and I thought the sort of compromise that we came to together on that was probably more preferable than the language here, but as this was offered some time ago, there hasn't been an opportunity to adjust the language there, but I certainly wouldn't oppose doing that.
Thank you. Representative Shragi.
Thank you, Chair Chris Tompkins. Through the chair to Representative Eastman. So, as I stated in prior committee hearings, I think the public oftentimes, and frankly, even candidates oftentimes, find contribution limits to be somewhat mystifying. And I think that adjusting the contribution limits annually could cause, I think, some additional confusion if each year everyone is having to reacquaint themselves with what the contribution limit is that year and whether it's changed. So for that reason, and because I have some concern that by doing the rounding calculation annually, that we could artificially inflate the contribution limit. Each time we have a year of high inflation, we could end up rounding up by $50, even though the true inflationary adjustment was maybe $30, and we're rounding up then to the nearest 50, that we artificially inflate that contribution limit higher and higher each year. So just for simplicity's sake and to avoid any additive upward pressure to that contribution limit, I'm opposed to the amendment, but I appreciate where you're coming from, certainly.
Other questions on amendment number three, Representative Klayman?
Not a question, but a comment. As to amendment number three, we did discuss a lot of different changes in connection with, I can't remember the bill number, but Rep. Josephson's APOC bill. And because that bill used shorter terms for renewal, I was pretty engaged in trying to figure out a way to modify that. But I actually generally agree with the bill sponsor that I think a 10-year cycle, given the public's less attention to these details than perhaps legislator and candidates' particular attention, I think we are better serving the public if we adjust that at the same time that we take up redistricting so that the changes all occur at roughly the same time. So I don't support amendment number three.
Representative Vance, did I see your hand up? Oh, forgive me. Other questions? Maybe just questions for now on amendment number three. Further comments on amendment number three, Representative Eastman?
Sure. You know, I think the declining the amendment or leaving it at 10 years effectively is the same as not inflation-proofing, particularly in over the coming decade when we're expecting that inflation is probably going to be a significant issue to whatever degree. And so what we'll end up, I think, if we leave it at 10 years, and I do agree that 1 year is too short, but if we leave it at 10 years, I think we're going to be back in the same exact spot as we're at now, where the court comes back and says, not good enough. And then we're going to have a law that's not being enforced, and then we're going to have APOC trying to figure out what to do because they can't enforce the current law, and they don't want no campaign, you know, no limit whatsoever, because that isn't what the public's requested. And, gosh, that doesn't seem like the best way to accomplish solving this problem. So I think 10 years is probably an unworkable length of time just for how it's going to be impacted in years where there is significant inflation. And I think somewhere over the next 10 years, there's going to be some significant inflation. So we should account for that and adjust this.
Thank you. I do want to afford you the opportunity for wrap up, Representative Eastman, but I also had a comment on this. I'm conflicted, I think, in a sort of policy vacuum, I prefer annual inflation adjustment, and that's generally a perspective that I hold across all realms of policy, including thresholds on felony property theft or anything else. I think it just makes sense and reflects reality. Representative Eastman, you and I also may have differing perspectives on the severity of inflation over the coming decade, although I certainly can see there will be inflation and probably more of it than we've seen in the last decade. The last thought, and I can't remember who made this comment when we were considering the parallel legislation from Representative Josephson, is I was very compelled, I guess, by, from a systems management perspective, that adjusting contribution limits is a big recurring change that will occur within the system of campaign contributions and regulation of campaign contributions. And I was very struck by the elegance of marrying those recurring changes with the redistricting cycle, and that there's just this kind of decadal reboot where everybody sort of gets used to a new normal, whether it's district lines, whether it's contribution limits. And I realize that that has nothing to do from, you know, like a pure legal perspective, and there we may be incurring legal risk by not having a more frequent than decadal adjustment to campaign contribution limits. But I just wanted to share those thoughts. I see it both ways, although I think ultimately I was really compelled, maybe because we're in the cycle of redistricting right now, of sort of marrying these two together, given that I've opened up comments. Yeah, Representative Coffin.
Thank you. Through the chair, to those comments, there's natural cycles. There's a two-year cycle. There's a four-year cycle. And then, you know, the 10 years with redistricting. So we might be able to find a cycle that's on a shorter cadence than 10 years, negate some of the concerns, and perhaps still build in that adjustment capability, but not make it so onerous to keep up with it every year.
Noted. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The point of the courts, if we choose not to limit the freedom of speech by means of political contribution, then we don't have to worry about adjusting for inflation, because the people get to determine the amount necessary when they make that contribution. So just a note on this conundrum with the amendment in the bill of whether or not we should need to adjust for inflation. The people will get to determine that when they determine what they deem appropriate by contribution.
Sounds like that's an endorsement of no contribution limits at all. Wow. point very well taken. Any other comments on amendment number 3, Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just always go back to, in terms of, you know, whether the time period is right or not, folks might remember when we increased the minimum wage that we also put a CPI adjustment into it. But if you go back to 2016, when it bumped up to 975, following that it went 980, 984, 989, 1019, then it was 1034, and it remained 1034 this year. So, I mean, just as a demonstration of, you know, the small amount of inflation we've seen over that period, I think we don't have to be quite as concerned about the unusual circumstance we're seeing right now, coming out of the pandemic and the supply chain disruptions that are, you know, causing this high demand situation. So I guess I, you know, feel like it's okay in this regard, that it's not going to be so dramatic that you're in a more typical times, you're, you know, buying power essentially of what your contribution means is going to be that dramatic over that time period. Thank you.
In any further comments, Representative Story?
I just wanted to comment, thank you through the chair, just on this conversation, and had several people ask me and just comment to me that they feel their speech is limited just by what their income is, and they cannot give their whole income to someone as a wealthy person can. So they feel that very much their speech is limited. So there's lots of thoughts about it, so it's interesting. Thank you.
And in wrap-up, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Well, I certainly don't want to do anything to weigh down optimism. I think it's important. My own perspective is that the days of low inflation are behind us, and that's a systemic reason, because we will need to see increasing levels of inflation going forward just to maintain the overall system. And whether that comes from, another war in Afghanistan, or whether it comes from a war somewhere else, or whether it comes from, another version of Build Back Better, it doesn't matter the reason. The inflation is going to be there because the increased spending needs to be there because our current system of debt, in essence, requires it. So until we've decided to step away from that and, overhaul our financial system, that is going to continue. So I think inflation will be significant. I think if we don't pass some kind of amendment, maybe this one, maybe another one, then what we're really doing is we're making an argument that whatever limit we set in this bill, $1,000 or whatever, that limit's actually going to become lower over the next 10 years because inflation will cause it to go lower. And at some point, as was the case, I think the courts are going to have to intervene and remind us that we've set it too low.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. I'll maintain my objection. Will the clerk please call the roll on adoption of Amendment Number 3?
Representative Tarr.
No.
Representative Story.
No.
Representative Clayman.
No.
Representative Vance.
Yes.
Representative Kaufman.
Yes.
Representative Eastman.
Yes.
No.
Three yeas, four nays.
By a vote of 3 yeas and 4 nays, adoption of Amendment Number 3 fails. And that takes us to the final amendment in the queue, as noted. This is Amendment Number 4, I.10, from myself, and I will move Amendment Number 4.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
There's an objection, and I will actually turn to Representative Shragi to this amendment.
Thank you, Chair Christ Tompkins. I'm going to pass this one over to my aide, Eric Gunderson.
For the record, Eric Gunderson, staff to Representative Shragi, through the chair. This amendment has a series of changes to the original bill. One of the primary changes is changing the limits to a per campaign period. This is similar to the amendments previously introduced by Representative Clayman. In doing so, it would increase the limit from the original CS HB 234 from $1,000 per year to $2,000 each campaign period for individuals. For both groups and non-groups, it would increase the limit from $2,000 to $4,000 per campaign period. It includes contributions. Apologies, one second. For Lieutenant Governor and Governor tickets, it would increase the limit from $2,000 per year to $4,000 per year for an individual. And then for a group or a non-group entity, it would allow them to donate $4,000, $8,000 each campaign period. It also changes the inflation adjustment date to begin in 2031 and then every 10 years thereafter. It defines campaign period and also notes that the Alaska Public Offices Commission may not change the manner or format in which reports are required of candidates to be reported during the campaign cycle.
Questions from the committee on Amendment Number 4?
And Chair Christ Tompkins, if I may.
Yes, Representative Shragi.
And just for the committee's information, we have distributed a printout of what this legislation would look like as amended. Or if this was an amendment were to pass, as I know there are quite a few changes in this amendment, I thought it might aid in the committee's understanding and following of this amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Shragi. Representative Eastman.
Have we considered any impacts that this might have on future campaigns? I'm just wondering if that's been taken into consideration. The future campaign account provisions, for example.
So the changes in this amendment would not impact the current status of future campaign accounts. So it would essentially be the same as they are if HB 234 were not to pass.
Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? Representative Eastman.
And just, can we get for the record the benefits of this new definition of campaign period? Obviously, we've got a system that we've had for some time. You know, like it or not, people are familiar with that system. What are the benefits of making this change?
Through the chair, for the record, Eric Gunderson, staff to Representative Shragi. When the current limits were challenged in both the Ninth Circuit and District Court, one of the areas in the Randall versus Sorrell decision after the Supreme Court remanded it back where Alaska's statutory limits failed was basically citing that they were essentially too low and made it a barrier for challengers running for office in the sense that they cited that most challengers don't actually file for office and begin fundraising the year prior to an election year. They usually file during an election year, whereas incumbents are typically fundraising year in and year out. By changing it to a per campaign cycle, it would essentially put challengers and incumbents on the same playing field with the same limits, regardless of when they jump in and enter the race.
Follow up.
So the way we're defining campaign period on line 6 of page 3 of the new version of the bill, shall we say, so we're talking about a candidate becoming eligible. And so, you know, this is going to tie back to the commission not changing the formatting of reports and so forth. How is that going to be interpreted? Is that going to be interpreted kind of literally as a particular candidate? Or is that going to be interpreted as any candidate in the state, once any candidate in the state becomes eligible to receive campaign contributions? So I guess the first candidate in the state that, say, files a letter of intent, you know, maybe. Which of those is going to be the way that this is interpreted?
Chair Christ Tompkins, I believe we have APOC online. I'd like to actually hear from them if we may.
We do. Both Heather Hebden and Tom Lucas from APOC are online, and maybe we'll start with you, Ms. Hebden, if you're available to take that question. Ms. Hebden, can you hear us? You can hear us, we cannot hear you. We're getting some noise.
Through the chair, can you hear me? My name is Tom Lucas.
Oh, yes, we can hear you, Mr. Lucas, yeah.
I believe Ms. Hebden is tied up in another hearing on the Senate side. So she is not present today.
Yeah, these are the joys of having House and Senate State Affairs scheduled at the same time. Okay, Mr. Lucas, if you're available, would you be able to field that question?
Through the chair, would it be possible for Representative Eastman to restate the question, please?
Yes, I sure can. All right, through the chair. So we're redefining campaign period through this amendment, and I know that's fair bit of it's different than what we used before. I'm going to take a shot in the dark and say that I think the intent would be that this campaign period be uniform for every candidate and therefore for the division. But the way that the language is worded, it's defining a campaign period for a candidate. And particularly a candidate becoming eligible to receive campaign contributions. So that isn't a calendar day, because you're not eligible to receive campaign contributions until you either file for office or at least file a letter of intent. So I'm wanting to make sure that in this amendment, in the underlying bill, that we have that uniform time period. Does this language accomplish that, or is there, you know, the potential or possibility that that this campaign period will be different in effect for different candidates or for different offices. If people, you know, if there's no candidate in a particular office or race or cycle that files on that first day, does that change this campaign period that we're defining?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastman, my read on this is that, indeed, for each individual candidate, it could be the campaign period could be a different number of days. Because the campaign period begins on the date that they file a letter of intent. And some candidates will file early, some candidates will file later. But regardless of the number of days in the campaign period, the amount of contributions that they can receive during their campaign period is equal to the amount of contributions that the candidate who filed earlier can receive.
Thank you.
Other questions for Mr. Lucas or for Representative Shragi? Seeing none, is the
brief at ease.
Representative Clayman.
Mr. Lucas, I want a little bit more clarity. Isn't it the case that right now under existing statutes, there's a limited period of time within which a candidate can collect contributions?
Through the Chair, Representative Clayman, that is correct.
And what is that period of time?
18 months prior to the election.
So if I start on a November, if it's November 1st, I go 18 months back before November 1st, and even if I filed a letter of intent 19 months, I couldn't raise a penny until 18 months came to be. Is that correct?
Through the Chair, Representative Clayman. Yes, that is correct.
And if I then also file my letter of intent 12 months before Election Day, even though I couldn't, even though my campaign period technically is that 12-month period starting when I file through Election Day, had I filed earlier, I could have had the longer period.
Through the Chair, Representative Clayman, yes, you can have a longer period, but you cannot receive any more contributions than someone who files later.
Right. It doesn't increase the amount of contributions available. It just says it gets to the period of time within which I can accept contributions, and that actually isn't just driven by when I file my letter of intent, it's also by the statute that limits the period during which I can collect contributions.
That is correct.
So as a large legal matter, the window for collecting contributions is 18 months before the election, which is somewhat further limited by when a candidate registers or files their letter of intent, but in no event can it be longer than the 18 months.
Through the Chair, Representative Clayman, that is correct.
I'm not sure I can get more clarity. I mean, I think the answer is the campaign period is that 18-month period limited by when you file. And I think that's what the intent of this language serves to do. Or I think that's what this language serves to do. It doesn't give anybody the ability to double dip in any way.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Yeah, and I don't think the double dipping is so much necessarily the issue, because I don't know that we're putting campaign period throughout every portion of the bill or the underlying statute. But if that is the intent, it sounds like it is. Maybe if we were to change, a candidate becomes eligible to receive campaign contributions to a candidate becomes eligible to file for office. That way, it would be uniform regardless of when you decided to become eligible to receive donations or whatnot. And maybe that would more clearly communicate the intent.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on that point, I guess if they're going to respond to that, I think that would be problematic because you can fundraise prior to filing to run. Right. So those can be two distinct separate periods of time where you were fundraising before you did any paperwork with the Division of Elections and were an official candidate. So I think having it synced up, like that's a distinct date and time. So May 8th I believe, of 2021, given that November 8th of 2022 is the election, you know, that date forward would have been when it would have been acceptable to do fundraising for the November 2022 general election cycle. So it's a fixed period of time. It doesn't seem to lack clarity. You look back 18 months from the date of the election. Seems to work better than trying to mix in when you might do your division of elections filing, which could be months later, but has to be by June 1st.
Representative Eastman.
Yeah, and I think that proves the point, because you can fundraise before you file for office, but you cannot fundraise before you're eligible to file for office, because that is what when the 18-month window starts. So if we were to simply make it say that you can't, your campaign period begins when you are eligible to file for office, and that would capture the whole length of time, even if you chose not to file until June 1st, whatever the deadline was, or letter intent, or any of that, it makes it uniform for all the candidates for that election cycle.
Are there any further questions or comments on the subject?
On that topic, no. I have comments. I'd have no questions, but comments as to the.
Well, comments more generally on this amendment as it relates to the bill, which is in a lot of ways Representative Playman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize that it may be somewhat, these comments are a little lengthy. In the United States Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission from 2010, as well as the court's decision in McCutcheon versus Federal Election Commission in 2014, the court limits restrictions on First Amendment speech in the realm of public or political contributions to actual quid pro quo corruption or its appearance. Those decisions have been recently reviewed carefully by the Ninth Circuit in the case that brings this bill before us, which is the Ninth Circuit case in Thompson v. Hebden, the Ninth Circuit decision from July 30th of 2021. And the Thompson versus Hebden decision specifically identifies five factors that should, the courts should consider, and I would suggest we should consider it looking at a bill like this. The first question is whether the limits would significantly restrict the amount of funding available for challengers to run competitive campaigns. The annual limits that are in the current statute, which of course has been ruled unconstitutional, significantly restrict funding available to challengers. Incumbents typically raise money in off years, while challengers typically register for the election in the election year and cannot double dip, as incumbents often do. This problem is even greater in the municipality of Anchorage because the fundraising period of 18 months includes three calendar years before the April elections, so that organized incumbents, and again, incumbents are typically far more organized than challengers, the incumbents can actually triple dip in the municipality of Anchorage under the current statutory structure. The proposed amendment changes that period from calendar year to campaign period and meets the first test in terms of not limiting funds available to challengers. The second question that the Ninth Circuit asks us to look at is whether political parties must abide by the same low limits that apply to individual contributors. And the proposed amendment allows political parties to contribute twice the amount in a campaign period as an individual contributor and thus meets the second test. The third test that the Ninth Circuit asks us to look at is whether volunteer services or expenses are considered contributions that count toward the limit. And the courts have generally not favored limits on volunteer services, and this bill does not limit volunteer services. The amendment and the bill, in fact, do not change the status quo in Alaska, which do not put limits on volunteer services. And so the bill meets the status quo and the third test. The fourth question is whether the limits are indexed for inflation. Both the Supreme Court and the Ninth Circuit note that Alaska's $500 contribution limit is the same as it was in 1996. And so any kind of inflation indexing goes back to 1996. And indexing that amount for inflation brings a total of slightly less than $1,000 if you inflation adjust that $500 and run it up to January 2022. It's actually easy to do on a Bureau of Labor Statistics website. They have a calculator. And applying this figure to an annual limit and then adjusting that for campaign to a campaign period leads to an approximately $2,000 limit, which is what you see in the amendment that, Mr. Chair, you have offered. The fifth question is whether there is any special justification for what might what that would warrant such low limits. And I think when the courts refer to low limits, they're referencing limits that are lower than the federal limits. And I think the federal limits, if you count both the primary and the general election for a Senate race or a U.S. House race, it would be $5,800. And so the query would be, is there a reason to have lower limits than $5,800? And again, I want to note that in looking at both quid pro quo and actual corruption, the Ninth Circuit very specifically noted that the Vico scandal, which has been a big topic here in Alaska, was actual evidence of criminal bribery, and there was not, and it was not an example of campaign corruption because the legislators in question put the money into their own pockets instead of their campaigns. So it doesn't get to campaign corruption. In the same area, in her separate statement in Thompson, Justice Ginsburg noted that the state government derives approximately 90% of its revenues from one economic sector, the oil and gas industry. And in the district court, Judge Burgess's opinion from 2016 also stated that Alaska receives 85 to 92% of its state revenue from the oil and gas industry, compared to less than 50% from every other state in the country. But in the years since Judge Burgess wrote his opinion in 2016, Alaska has changed from being an oil state to being an investment state. In the last 2 years, oil and gas taxes are significantly less than 50% of the state revenue, and permanent fund earnings have been 60 to 70% of state revenue. That structural change in state government funding should change the quid pro quo analysis if a court is to look at this law. The average dividend amount for the 5 years since Judge Burgess wrote his opinion in 2016, and that's the 2017 through 2021 dividends, the average dividend amount is $1,282.40. This amount aligns quite closely with the proposed $2,000 campaign period limit on an individual contribution in the amendment. This alignment between the average dividend amount for 2 years with the campaign period limit is actually a special justification for this limit, because it essentially says that a person that wants to choose to spend their dividend amount as political speech and expend that on campaigns as a way of exercising their influence on how that money is spent, and that alignment between the limit and the dividend amount, I think, is a significant factor that should be considered looking at this amendment, and why I am in support of this amendment and in the $2,000 individual limit. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Klayman. That seemed well researched and rehearsed. Perhaps we'll have Bering at a future moment in a different branch of government. Any further comments on amendment number four, Representative Eastman?
Thank you. It occurs to me that the change of the campaign period certainly adds some simplicity as far as the current system and the public understanding it. It doesn't, however, really, as was stated earlier, it doesn't really have anything to do with the future campaign account provisions. So even with this passage, the donation is just to the candidate. So if the candidate wants to take money from other campaigns, this limit of $4,000 doesn't touch that. Because the money is coming from a future campaign account, and then that money added to $4,000 is where you find the actual legal limit. So if we're ever going to look at changing that, just this amendment isn't going to do it for us. I think that it's a novel approach. Maybe we're seeing how it works. Until you've done it, I don't know that we can say exactly what's going to happen, but it's interesting.
Further comments? Seeing none, is the objection to amendment number four maintained?
I'll withdraw my objection.
Representative Eastman?
I will withdraw my objection.
Is there further objection? Seeing none, amendment number four is adopted, and that takes us to the bill as amended as a whole. Are there comments on the legislation as a whole, recognizing that you kind of were just countenancing that subject. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's sorry if we had already covered it and I'd forgotten in the process of these like two somewhat related pieces of legislation. But on this, we have an effective immediate date. And I was just wondering if we needed to consider like this gray area where it's just been under advisory opinion but not adopted, and if there'd be any reason that we would want to consider like a different effective date. And I don't know if the bill sponsor thought of that or had any information they could share.
Representative Shaggy.
Yeah, Chair Christ Tompkins. I'm actually going to pass that to my aide, Eric Gunderson, who has had conversations with APOC and researched that subject.
Since we actually have Tom Lucas from APOC on the line, I will defer to him.
Mr. Lucas, you're the third person to get the hot potato of this question. Mr. Lucas, are you with us? Mr. Lucas? Mr. Gunderson, would you be able to offer your understanding and answer that question?
Through the chair, I will do my best. So in my discussions with Tom Lucas through APOC, essentially with the effective date taking place after APOC's advisory opinion has been in place, candidates who, say, have raised $1,500 this year and $1,500 next year would not have to give back any, they would not be required under statute to give back any money, but they could not raise any more. So for instance, if a candidate had raised an aggregate of $2,501 over the last 2 years, they could not raise beyond the $2,000 limit in the current bill as amended.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so then, Mr. Gunderson, is it your understanding then in that circumstance that the $501 then, just like in a as is typical, if we get a donation that would have exceeded the $500 limit, we're still required to give that back, report it, and then give it back. So in this circumstance, they're not going to have to give it back? Is that what you're saying?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, it's our understanding that if the donation, as long as the contributions received to date have been in line with the advisory opinions provided by APOC, that no donations above what was no donations will have to be returned to donors so long as they didn't go above that advisory $1,500 limit in each yearly cycle. So they may have received more than the $2,000 established through this bill. However, because they had generated that, those contributions prior to this bill going into effect, they would be able to retain those donations and would not, but would no longer be able to receive any more funds from those donors. I hope that clarifies the situation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's going to be interesting to see how that people respond in their behavior to that.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and I appreciate Representative Tarr for raising the issue. I think that does sort of put a different view on the underlying bill, because it's going to, in effect, give an advantage to incumbents, or at least incumbent candidates. Those who've received, you know, $3,000 from one person now have an advantage, because if someone didn't receive that $3,000 or files for office, you know, anytime this year, running for election, they can only receive a maximum of $2,000 from a donor. I think that kind of tilts it in the direction of incumbents, of which I am one. I'd like there not to be that disparity. I think my recommendation is that we would maybe solve that by making it effective at the end of the current campaign period. We've got a definition of campaign period in the bill now. Maybe it starts at the beginning of the next campaign period.
Chair Christ Tompkins, if I may. Sorry. Through the chair, so I have two responses to that question, and I agree. It does bring up a concern that it does give an incumbent an advantage. I readily concede that. I would note, however, that without this bill and without the without this bill, if we were to retain the yearly contribution limit, that advantage already exists. And I would say it actually exists to a much greater degree. If I began my fundraising efforts as an incumbent last year and my opponent didn't start until this year, I effectively can collect double what the challenger would be able to collect. And so while this does still retain a temporary advantage to incumbents, it corrects it moving forward. And the advantage that would exist during this current campaign cycle is much less of an advantage that exists today, right now. The second point that I would make with respect to having an effective date that is beginning the next campaign cycle is it would leave all of us and all those who challenge us in this election year under the advisory guidance from APOC, which, frankly, I have heard now two members of the public opine has no authority. And so they some members of the public are under the understanding today that they could go out and receive a $50,000 donation, and that would be just fine. And APOC would have no authority to limit that contribution or force them to return any of that to their contributor. So I think you raise a very valid concern. However, I think this bill provides a substantial remedy to the status quo that we have today and the imperfection of giving an incumbent an advantage is a mild advantage and it is temporary. Thank you.
Representative Klayman.
I would just note that my sense is that the public, A, likes having campaign contribution limits. The majority of the public, and I think that the significant majority of the public is not necessarily paying every daily attention to the progress of these issues in the legislature and in the state. And so I think that a return to some reasonable campaign finance limits, I think, is one of the ways we can show the public that we are responsive to their concerns.
Any further comments on this subject? Seeing none. Representative Klayman, a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to report CS for House Bill 234, State Affairs version 32-LS1197/I out of committee with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal note. And that would be the version as amended. I didn't say that before.
Is there any objection? Seeing and hearing none, the motion to move House Bill 234, State Affairs Committee Substitute, as amended, carries. Thank you very much, Representative Shragi and Mr. Gunnarsson, for all your work and for the committee, for all the time and attention on this subject across two different pieces of legislation. As a final note, and per some asynchronous, if informal, communication that has unfolded over the last hour, I would like to make a motion, as committee members have been advised, and the motion is I would move that I, as chair, be authorized to introduce State Affairs Committee legislation relating to Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation investment and divestment in assets relating to Russia.
I'll object for discussion.
Thank you, Representative Smith, and I want to add a couple of comments to this. On this committee legislation, well, first on process in now my 6 years with this committee, have never opted to have a blanket authorization motion for committee legislation. I just prefer it for process, clarity, and communication reasons. And if people have reservations about a committee bill, that they are given the opportunity to express that, and there's sort of an opportunity. So just generally, I feel like that's important. And while this is sort of a fast-moving thing, still want to make sure that everyone is afforded the opportunity to consider the motion. And then secondly, as far as this particular subject, my interest is mostly bringing it before the committee for discussion to better understand what this means, what precedent does or does not exist with APFC. For instance, I'm not in this moment certain what APFC did or did not do versus, say, South African apartheid-related investment in the whatever that was, late 80s, early 90s. So this will not be a ASAP railroaded piece of committee legislation, given that personal legislation bill deadline has passed. that is really the sort of primary motivation for this motion. So fully respect all perspectives, but just wanted to share that additional context for Representative Eastman.
And I may, I'm not sure, but I may be the only sponsor of a divestment bill currently in the legislature, unless there's others I'm not aware of. In that bill, there's, you know, some care taken to have a period of time for divestment, and there's some process there, and the corporation has some time, and the state has some time, and there's some benchmarks. And I'm curious, since this is kind of a blanket authorization, I hope we're not asking them to ditch investments like tomorrow, just because of the financial costs of making those kinds of quick decisions. But then also, you know, maybe the intent wouldn't be accomplished by a more orderly, you know, 6-month, you know, process. So how would that work?
TBD. But I would be happy to sort of share a copy of the draft legislation with the committee and incorporate feedback. And that's, of course, no guarantee that there's 7 of 7 member alignment on the subject by any means, but certainly would be sincerely interested in feedback. And Representative Eastman, you probably know more about the subject than I do, given your legislation. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate having the conversation and learning more before we make any final decision, because while we have high opinions about the current situation with Russia, I find it interesting that this is the action that would prompt this discussion when they have embargoed our seafood since at least 2013. That has greatly impacted our ability to raise revenues on our seafood industry, which employs the most Alaskans out of any other industry. And we're choosing this issue to look at possible divestments from the permanent fund as an action, alerting Russia that we are not happy with what they're doing. So I think that we need to be very prudent in our decisions and not have a knee-jerk reaction, because this one is on the world stage, but look at how this action could impact Alaska in the future. So I do appreciate having a conversation and making sure that we're making a wise decision.
Representative Klayman? Oh, sorry, I thought nope, Representative nope. Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just add, I know this isn't the first conversation about this, because earlier in my service, there was questions about investments in the Sudan because of, you know, civil war and genocide issues there as well. So I think the opportunity for clarity, and just times change, and sometimes, you know, our perspective on something changes. And so maybe it's just a good time for a refresh for all of us to understand it better. And then, you know, if necessary, add some clarity to what we want is the direction going forward. So I support that. Thank you.
Any further comments? Representative Story.
Thank you for the comments. I appreciate them. In this situation, I feel like time is of the essence in the matter of working on this to state clear and moral message of what is happening to the Ukrainian people. And we do not want to be a part of it in any way.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And maybe the answer to all the questions is TBD, but maybe it's not. I'm hopeful to get a little bit more clarity. So do we know how much investment the permanent fund, how much of that is currently invested in assets that would get caught up in this? And do we have sort of a more concrete definition of what this is? Is this assets that are controlled by the Russian government or tangentially related to a Russian national? All right. Can you give us a little bit more?
Yeah, Representative Eastman, my answers to those questions mostly will draw on reporting in the ADN, I think, from yesterday. I think there's circa $200 million of Russia sort of assets that are Russian, I think categorized by, you know, Russian equities or securities or whoever, who knows what other sort of asset classes might exist. I mean, most of those, if I'm remembering from the article, correctly are equities in Russian companies like oil and gas companies or banks or other companies and are just sort of Russian in nature. I mean, to be honest, I think this is the kind of question I would hope to thoroughly probe in committee with the Permanent Fund Corporation. I don't know how precedented this is in state history. I also think the sort of what we're seeing globally is also unprecedented really since World War II, you know, a full land invasion of a sovereign country just being gobbled up by another. But I think they're very important questions. And I also think, I mean, just given the scale, that $200 million figure as reported, we want to be extremely clear-eyed, sober, and deliberate in thinking about the process, the scope, and the policy here, because nothing, you know, against Sudan, but I imagine the number of assets invested that relate to Sudan are microcosmic relative to a country the size of Russia. So I think this is a serious action and would want to sort of make sure the process reflects that. Yes, Representative.
I guess a comment, maybe more than a question. Just from an economic perspective, it would seem to me, and I've got some benefit of having thought through some of these things with my current bill, but I'm all for, and you can find it in my bill, specifically calling out Ukraine as a trading partner of ours and not investing in entities that are attacking someone like Ukraine or trying to eliminate their sovereignty and take over their country. That said, from an economic perspective, I would imagine, and I haven't looked at the analysis yet, but I would imagine that a lot of Russian assets, maybe the $200 million we're considering, have over the last week significantly lost value. And so if we're going to be, in essence, selling those significantly depressed valuation items, which one would expect at some point in the future, they'll go back up to something approaching what they were before. That's another reason why you might want a period of time before divesting, because if we're just trying to make a political statement, that could end up being a very expensive political statement, and I don't know about how effective or not effective the statement will be.
Yeah, I think that's something we should fully understand before taking any action. I would agree. And I mean, just to add, not that I am any expert in sort of the rationale of divestment. I think in this scenario, I mean, there's also a potential trajectory where some of these asset valuations are perhaps on a long-term trajectory of approaching zero too. And but I mean, if it's an economic motivation, hopefully the asset managers are taking that into account, however they might be able to. But yes, I think it's an important question. Any further comments?
I'll obtain or maintain my objection because just generally speaking, the blanket authorizations I think I'm generally opposed to. But I appreciate the discussion and conversation.
Sure. And just to clarify, although that's noted, what I mean by blanket authorization is it's not uncommon that at the start of a two-year legislature, a committee chair will entertain a motion that gives them blanket authorization to introduce any committee bill sort of by fiat, and that's just what I was referring to. But I understand blanket in the sense referring to a large scope of policy that relating to APFC divestment from Russia. Well, with the objection maintained, will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Eastman.
I know.
Representative Tarr.
Yes.
Representative Story.
Yes.
Representative Klayman.
Yes.
Representative Vance.
No.
Representative Coffin.
No.
Yes.
Four yeas, three
nays. By a vote of four yeas, three nays, the authorization to introduce committee legislation relating to APFC investment and divestment and assets relating to Russia passes. I'll be in communication with the committee when we have bill drafts. All my comments still stand. and we will all, I suspect, be learning more about the subject. So with that, no further business before the committee. We'll be back on Thursday. Again, as noted, no amendments for HJR 29 or SB 71. I think a little bit more time is prudent there, but we will take public testimony. Hopefully we'll have legislative, legal, and Department of Law for SB 71. And with that, at 5:01 p.m., we are adjourned.